Greetings, kindred witches. Welcome to this episode of Atomic Witchcraft.
Here, we share our experiences as we build a modern-day inclusive witchcraft practice rooted in nature seasons, celestial cycles, and the science of energy.
Join us as we build a craft that learns from our past, is rooted in our present, and works toward building a better future, all while connecting deeply to the earth and sky around us.
Let us begin a new era of witchcraft. Hi everyone, I'm Ash, an atomic witch walking an eclectic road since the 90s.
I'm Alyssa, about 20 years in and growing a mostly green path.
And I'm Jay, new to the practice, composing a bard witch's craft. Because witch weaves together many webs, past, present, and future, we'd like to acknowledge that we are currently practicing our craft on the lands of the Coast Salish peoples, specifically the Duwamish, Muckleshoot, and Puyallup tribes.
The Atomic team participates in Real Rent, and we encourage you to engage with and contribute to similar programs in your area.
Welcome to our grove, here at the Atomic Hearth. Now, let's get witchy. Welcome back to the Atomic Hearth. Hey, it's Ash, and as we approach this October new moon, we thought it might be fun to touch on a topic we don't talk much about, tarot. As a divination tool, it falls into the psychology of science and a little belief, as well as the power of tapping into our imaginations and subconscious. And while I use an oracle deck regularly, this will be my first time really diving into the history, science, and systems of tarot, so consider this episode a kickoff to my 101 approach. Then, like last time, we'll be featuring our usual segments, including Charting the Celestial, where we'll talk more about some more upcoming meteor showers, learn the story of Queen Cassiopeia, and find magic in the molecules as cosmic travelers. Our quarterly subject, which will be Passion Project this time, where we put the craft in witchcraft, talking about the creative projects we have our hands on. And finally, Resistance Radio, to bring you methods mundane and magical to connect to your craft into community and activism. This lunar cycle, we are talking about the tactics of the quiet subversive. So let's lift off into this cosmos for our first section, Charting the Celestial.
Eyes on the sky. What's in the sky for this coming new moon to new moon cycle? You know it. You love it. It's another meteor shower. Actually, there's two this cycle.
Just two?
I know, right? Honestly, doing this astronomy segment throughout the year has made me realize just how many showers we experience. I feel like I would only hear about like the really big ones, like the Perseids. So learning about just how frequently they actually are has been really cool.
Really anyway. Kind of takes that probability into, like, us getting hit by something a little bit.
Optimistically just sort of makes you think about how active everything is.
It's October 21st to the 22nd. We have the peak of the Orionids meteor shower. Under dark sky conditions, you can expect to see roughly around 20 meteors per hour. These are fast-moving, hitting speeds of about 41 miles per second when they hit the atmosphere. They're also on the fainter side. But the unique aspect of these meteors is that they often leave trails of ionized gas in the sky that linger for several seconds after the initial streak, kind of like a trail, like a ghost trail. The Orionids also have a good chance of producing fireballs, which are exceptionally bright shooting stars that light up the night sky. The parent comet for this particular show is Halley's Comet, which its radiant point is the constellation Orion. The best viewing time is after midnight and kind of closer to 2 a.m. when Orion is at its highest point in the sky for this time of year. Thankfully, the peak falls on a new moon, so assuming there is no cloud coverage, you should have fairly optimal viewing conditions. Of course, it's always best to be away from urban lights and to be able to see as much of the sky as possible by stargazing somewhere like a field. These meteors tend to be sort of scattershot across the sky, so lying on a blanket or reclining in a chair and just looking up will suffice. The Orionids can be viewed in both hemispheres, but most will be spotted in the northern one. Late October through early November, you can see the unique show that is the Taurids meteor shower. This particular show doesn't have a definitive peak date, but there is a full moon on November 5th, so trying to catch it before or after that will make for the best viewing. What makes the Taurids unique is that it is made up of particles from two different streams, and therefore technically two different meteor shows with slightly offset timings. The first one, the South Torrids, runs from late September through mid-November. The second, the North Torrids, lights up the sky from mid-October through early December. That overlap period where both showers are occurring at the same time is the best for viewing. Because they are two different showers, they have two different parent sources. The South Stream comes from the comet 2P, aka Encke. The North Stream comes from a small group of asteroids, potentially up to 10, that likely were broken off of a much larger comet at one point in time. Most likely the same large comet that Encke came from as well. As the name implies, the Taurids radiant is the constellation Taurus. The South Stream appears to be coming from a point very close to Taurus, while the North Stream sits a little bit higher in the sky from it, and a bit closer to the cluster of stars known as the Pleiades. On a cloud-free night in late October, head outside around midnight and head to an area where a clear view of the sky is. Taurus hangs out in the east this time of year, so turning away from that direction will aid in getting the best show. The overlap period of the Taurids will yield around 10 meteors per hour that appear quite bright and slow-moving. Like the Orionids, this shower is prone to fireballs, so keep a close eye to the sky. The Taurids are visible equally from both hemispheres. In the northern hemisphere, we begin to see Cassiopeia rising in the northeast skies in the evenings. Now, this is a circumpolar constellation, meaning it doesn't dip below the horizon throughout the year, but the autumn through winter is when she tends to reign higher in the sky, hitting a peak around 9 p.m. Cassiopeia is best recognized by the M, or W, depending, shaped asterism, marked by the five brightest stars in the constellation. I find that once you spot this asterism for the first time, it's hard to not keep seeing it in the night sky. This M shape, plus the surrounding celestial bodies, are supposed to represent Queen Cassiopeia. Apparently, the M shape is her sitting on a throne. Maybe if you really use your imagination, you can see it. I've also heard that some see the M as her crown, which I can definitely visualize a little bit better. On a dark night in autumn, head outside around 9 p.m. and look north. It's going to be pretty easy to find Cassiopeia if we first find Polaris, aka the North Star, and its neighbor, the Big Dipper. I go over how to do this in detail in episode 138, but I'll be brief here. Polaris is located in the asterism the Little Dipper, which looks like a ladle, and is mirrored in the night sky by a similarly shaped but larger asterism, the Big Dipper. Once you have found the latter, move your eyes slightly east. Cassiopeia is directly opposite the Big Dipper as it rotates around Polaris. In the southern hemisphere, this is the best time of year to view the small and large Magellanic clouds. They appear in the sky as big, misty blobs of light and are sometimes mistaken for clouds in our atmosphere. They are in fact two satellite irregular galaxies, some of the closest ones to our Milky Way. They are considered satellites because they are gravitationally bound to our home galaxy, and labeled as, quote, irregular, because they have no distinct shape, such as a spiral like our own. The small cloud is about 200,000 light years away, and contains an estimated 3 billion stars. The larger is only 160,000 light years away, and houses an estimated 30 billion stars. This is another one of those night sky marvels that is going to need the most ideal conditions in order to get the best view of it. A new moon, no cloud coverage, no urban lights, and a clear view south. You may even want to break out the binoculars to see some of the details. Since these objects are circumpolar, we're going to use our old friend Crux to help spot them. While facing south, find Crux using the methods in episode 140. And be mindful not to be tricked by the nearby False Cross asterism. The small Magellanic cloud lies almost directly opposite of Crux around the South Pole in the night sky. So if you follow the line leading from the bottom of the cross, you will spot the cloud. The large Magellanic cloud lies between the smaller one and the bright star Canopus in the constellation Carina from episode 142. This cloud is easier to spot as it is, well, larger and also brighter. Though the use of some maps and apps is always encouraged here. The Magellanic Clouds are named after explorer, slaver, and notorious colonizer, Magellan. There has recently been a point raised in the scientific community that these celestial bodies shouldn't bear the name of such a person, especially since they held their own names, and significance in many indigenous communities long before he ever reached the Southern Hemisphere. I love these moments when science and witchcraft hold a similar view, that there is power in a name, and we should be mindful of that power.
There are certainly legends from around the many cultures of our world which portray royal figures as mighty, righteous, and achievers of great things. There are others, however, which tell of royal flaws, faults, and foibles, and our celestially seated Queen Cassiopeia guides us to this kind of tale today. The legend of Cassiopeia has inspired plays, poems, novels, operas, songs, and paintings. So how has this queen sat eternally above us, never to rest below the horizon in her circumpolar spot? This story from the Greeks explains how hubris and vanity is properly rewarded when the angry seas are providing the prize. Queen Cassiopeia was the wife of King Cepheus and mother to her beautiful daughter Andromeda. The queen was boastful and vain of both her own beauty and anything which she claimed her own, including her offspring. One day, Cassiopeia made a bold and very public announcement for all to hear and know. It was a boastful declaration that her daughter, Andromeda, was more beautiful than the Nereids. Now, this was quite the statement to make, for the Nereids were the godlike spirits of the sea, ruled and protected by the god Poseidon himself, brother of Zeus. The Nereids took immediate and ample offense to the queen's bold statement and demanded to Poseidon that she be punished for her arrogance. Poseidon did not hold back his response. Dark clouds gathered and howling winds rose, and suddenly the Aegean Sea rose up in a terrible swell, flooding the coast and kingdom in disastrous measure. Among the tumultuous waves, an additional threat charged forth, with the sea monster Cetus arriving to further assault and torment the city and its people. In panic, the king rushed to a wise oracle, desperate to for a way to end this divine punishment from the sea. The aged figure peered out from their hooded robe and said,
"The only way to appease the monster and the sea god himself is to sacrifice the object of the queen's boasting. Do so, and your salvation shall arrive."
So it was decided that Andromeda, who had no part in this whole ordeal, I must add, was chained to a rock by the sea for the sea monster Cetus to devour, in hope that this would absolve Queen Cassiopeia of the crimes of her vanity. And so their salvation did arrive, but perhaps not as they expected. The great Cetus rose up from the waters, its scales shimmering, its jaws filled with jagged fury, when at the last minute a savior appeared at the scene. The hero Perseus, on the winged sandals from Hermes, a tale from another time, rescued her by slaying the great sea serpent with a magical sword he had just used to slay the Gorgon Medusa. Upon saving her and quelling this source of the kingdom's woes, he was so smitten by Andromeda that he asked the king and queen for her hand in marriage. But all was not settled with the mighty Poseidon. He wasn't going to let off the queen so easily simply by way of the heroics of Perseus. He had a final, eternal punishment in mind, which could not be solved by the sword. Poseidon placed her high as he could in the night sky, seated upon her throne so far north that she was doomed to circle the North Star Polaris forever. Not only that, but she would have to spend half of every night upside down. Forever, she would be turned and tossed about, as if still caught in the mighty waves and the whirlpools of Poseidon's seas below. So be humble, my friends, and be careful to compete with the beauty of nature's wonders. You never know who might be listening. A reminder that when one plays foolish games, one wins foolish prizes. And so these stories are told, drawn from the crisscrossing arcs and swirls above our magical minds. The cosmic cornucopia calls us to lie back, look up, and let our minds wander and wonder, as cultures around the world map their skies in a wonderful diversity of stories and interpretations. We encourage you to learn about the stories in your culture and of the ancestors on the land on which you reside.
As meteor showers decorate the sky upon which sits the crown of Queen Cassiopeia, the sources of this display are magic in the molecules of their own. Comets, the great cosmic travelers, the epic arcs that trace through time and shape destinies. The meteors that rain down can change the course of life upon impact on a planet or surface. And even more, frozen in the core of these destiny makers is life itself. Comets are comprised of two key aspects, its coma and its tail. These are created as these small ice orbs pass near a star, or in this case, our sun, the heat of which begins to melt or steam away the ice holding the comet together. This outgassing creates the beautiful glowing ember we see as it passes within visuals of Earth's trajectory. Up close, however, comets get the nickname dirty snowball because, well, that's kind of what they are. Ice that has been frozen with various elements and rocks. The amazing thing is that these elements can date back to the beginning of our solar system, some 4.6 billion years ago, making them molecular time capsules as they travel the length and time of space, often stuck in orbits in the outer reaches of our solar system, either the Oort cloud or the Kuiper belt being common homes. Then, if the comet makes its way inward, drawn by the gravitation of the star at the center of our cosmic system, the solar radiation and waves give the comet its fancy little tail as the comet sublimates and outgasses, creating the glowing dome of the coma. These beautiful night sky ice embers have been the source of stories and legends throughout history, often as bad omens, signing the changing of the tides. Wikipedia cites the example of this 1066 passage of Halley's Comet, depicted as heralding the Norman conquest of England, while other cultures saw these as signs of the gods, their fire-tipped arrows or cigars even. But comets aren't just discoveries of the ancient world. The newly spotted comet 3IA Atlas is charting its own course. Yet comets don't only make stories, they hold stories. The stories of our solar system's creation. Which brings me to some of our pillars of which for us here on the Atomic Team. Which as keeper of knowledge, wisdom, and story. Keepers of the histories that hold us, the stories that inspire us or warn us. Especially in these times, how do we as which not only hold the histories, but also dream a way forward? Which as dreamer, as a weaver, how do we hold the elements of our past and shape the destiny of our futures? Much like those comets we see arcing across our skies. Hey all, it's Ash. I am back again a little sooner than usual because we thought this lunar cycles topic would be apt for the witching season, shadow work, and just in time for all spirits. The topic? Tarot. For me, this topic is one that I have danced around for most of my practice. I acquired an oracle deck in my early years, and honestly, I just never wanted to stray. And it has become somewhat of a grounding element to my practice.
We love a good oracle deck.
Yeah, which unfortunately means, like, I never really got into tarot. And I know that sounds weird for a science-based practice to, like, I include oracle, but we'll talk a little bit more about that. You know, it helps provide perspective and new lenses to view situations. Mm-hmm. And tarot, on the other hand, has always felt a little complicated for
me. There's a lot of cards and a lot of meanings.
Too many cards. There's 78 cards.
I felt that way too, for sure.
Although, you know, actually I was looking at my oracle deck and there's almost as many cards.
But I feel like oracle decks are a little bit more straightforward than tarot.
I don't know.
I don't sometimes.
So I'm going to spend the next three lunar cycles digging into tarot, really learning a little bit more. So I'm excited for that because I'm not new to tarot, but I'm new to tarot. Mm-hmm. So while I have a sense of the basics and a high level of confidence working with my oracle deck, I want to explore the variations and unique ways that different witches use tarot, from the different ways we shuffle and draw to the variety of spreads and layouts to storage and care. You know, I'm curious to see how different witches approach the concept of drawing for others. You know, largely because from a science-based perspective, you know, tarot plays the role of the spiritual coach. So it's really meant for you, and improvised lenses we can like shift or understand perspectives. So it's not really about fortune telling for me. So it gets a little more complicated when reading for others. So I'm curious to see how people approach that. You know, it, for me, it's an outside voice in the conversation, one that's kind of mathematically based on probability, you know, the literal underlying math of our universe, which is pretty amazing.
I love that.
There's a lot of math in our universe to tap into.
It's pretty good stuff. And you get into like the probability of us being here and oof, mind blown.
Oh, God, I can't think about it. It's too much.
Tarot has, over the years, kind of become a staple of witchcraft and occult practices. However, it definitely did not start out that way. In fact, tarot was just a version on simple playing cards used in Italy to play a similar game to what we call bridge, and it was called tarocchi, meaning fool or joker. The original set includes batons instead of wands and coins instead of pentacles, along with swords and cups. Then around 1440, allegorical cards were added to create the Carte de Triomphe, or the Triumph cards, which were added, essentially the birth of the major arcana. According to Magic, Witchcraft, and the Occult by DK Publishing, this started to take on an occult leaning in 1773 when French scholar Antoine Cour de Jablon wrote a book on the ancestry of language called The Primitive World. In this, Jablon argued that tarot symbols were actually based on a mysterious ancient Egyptian text, the Book of Thoth, or Teote if you want to use the assumed Egyptian dialect. We actually talked about this book in one of our recent episodes on the history of occult. However, when later translations were done of the book, there were no signs or correlations to tarot that were ever found. It did, however, ignite an occult interest in the tarot deck.
I remember the first time I found out that tarot was originally just playing cards. In my mind, I was like, wait, the fact that it's this mystical, magical thing is... It's playing cards?
Yeah, and some of that is, I guess, maybe why I actually hesitated there. I was like, the playing cards, like what... How is that going to be useful?
I know that you can do like sort of divination readings with an actual deck of like playing cards that we think of them. So that's really interesting to me too. But like it was just so funny to learn this as a young witch and just be like, what?
So that's the first thing I did. Because as listeners, longtime listeners may recall, I was terrified of tarot cards for years. And so when I was starting into my witch for literally no reason, not a well-defined reason, it was just this illogical fear and of spooky things. And so when I started, even after us coming together and doing some things, I started with a playing card deck first, and I would do the three card pulls for like kind of yes no divination questions. It felt more comfortable, but then someone gifted me a tarot deck and I was like, well, here we go, I guess.
So about a decade after this, right, so after this exploration into the Book of Teote, Jean-Baptiste Alliette wrote a book on how to use tarot for divination, the book called The Art of Reading Cards. Now, Alliette established a pattern for reading the meaning of each card, including how its orientation would have a shift or reverse meaning if it was upside down. Then, enter Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn,
our old friends,
who began to weave together astrology and tarot, tying the astrological signs to the elements and to specific suits of cards. Kabbalah also began to include tarot when, in 1860, Alpheus Levi matched the 22 trump or major arcana cards to the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Mm. Going a step further, in 1889, Swiss occultist Oswald Wirth pulled out most cards to create a deck solely from the major arcana. He tied each of these cards to Kabbalist symbols, linking them together. Over time, tarot really goes from playing cards to cardomancy. And at first, each set of cards was hand-etched, unique, and rare. This was before the printing press, right? Mm-hmm. Then the printing press comes along and they become more mass-produced, right? First as playing cards, then as a tool for the occult. And there are a few manifestations of the system we actually see today. So like I said, there was lots of versions. We saw that in play. And so today now we see the Tarot of Marseille, the Thoth or Teote deck, and most common for us, the Rider-Waite-Smith deck. Mm-hmm. Now, for those of you that are wondering, why did I add the word or the name Smith after Rider-Waite? Well, it's important to know that the illustrator of those cards was a woman named Pamela Coleman Smith. She was a member of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and her work was accompanied by instructions and descriptions from a mystic and academic, R.E. Waite. and published by Ryder and Sons. So just like Hasbro is a publisher of the Ouija board, when you say Rider-Waite, you're actually just talking about the publisher and the guy who wrote the little book that goes with it. Nothing about the actual cards themselves. So that was all Pamela Coleman Smith. So always make sure you add that Smith so that it's the Rider-Waite Smith. And as far as I'm concerned, you could call it the Waite Smith deck or the Smith deck.
I actually own a deck of this card style that is, it is called on the box, the Smith-Waite deck. Instead of the Ryder Smith or Ryder Waite deck or whatever. And I was like, heck yeah, all right.
Yeah, we don't have need like the Waite Smith target deck. You know, we can kick the brand name out of there necessarily.
And you know, it's just it's to pay attention that Waite and Ryder, both men, left Smith's name off that deck.
Yeah. Intentionally.
And this is where we as witches can shape history to make sure we are always include her name in referencing her work and or the variations.
Damn right.
It's her visuals that have shaped our understanding and connections. The descriptions and instructions tend to vary, but her work has inspired countless other artistic expressions of the deck. So today we see many variations on that artwork, everything from nature themes to The Simpsons. There are really tarot decks out there for every style, and there is never a shortage. As for acquiring decks, there is some weird trend being circulated on the witchy nets that you have to be gifted a tarot deck, that you cannot buy one for yourself. And I'm going to just call wrong on that. Tarot, in my personal belief anyway, is actually something best purchased by you, just like any of your other tools. You know, they need to ring true to you and what you're hoping to connect with. And that being said, I'm a little hesitant to be like, go buy all the decks, because it's not that either. You could honestly, and maybe more effectively, create your own deck with imagery very unique to you. You could even make a deck strictly out of sigils or symbols. I'm also really interested in how tarot can be used to support other journeys, like activism. So I'm reading a book, Tarot for the Hard Work by Maria Menes, which is both a great read and a hands-on workbook for continuing my anti-racism work. In it, Maria uses each of the major arcana to delve into an aspect of the journey, which I think really offers a very practical way that tarot can be applied to everyday lives. Much like the elements and even astrology and astronomy in my practice, it offers an optional lens with which we can view the world. Mm-hmm. It helps us understand, make meaning, two things that are pretty essential to our experience as humans, actually. You know, so as always, I like to start with community. And I know that you both, Jay, Alyssa, and probably all of you out there engage with tarot and or oracle decks. And I'm just curious to hear how you incorporate them into your practice. And then maybe a bit more specifically, do you have any techniques that you just literally love for shuffling, drawing, layout, storing, handling?
Yeah, I mean, once I got over my fear, you know, as I have mentioned pretty regularly on this podcast, I use tarot pretty often. It tends to fall into three specific areas. I'd say first, sometimes I'll draw cards as sort of an in-the-moment discernment tool. Basically, if something in my day is really throwing me for a loop, or I've got something on my mind and it's hard to properly put it into like a shape or words, this is probably my most off-the-cuff and least measured way to use my deck. And I'll admit the results aren't always clarifying or helpful. It's like pretty off the cuff from the hip. Usually I need to be a little more intentional and focused, which leads me to specific area number two, which is meditation and reflection. I've definitely brought this up for each of my topics. I'll use my deck to draw cards following a meditation on a specific question or path ahead of me. I'll kind of think about the question, then I'll meditate, then I'll draw cards after sort of experience whatever the meditation showed me or kind of made me think about. They kind of act as sort of the epilogue to the story of my meditation, and often raises like ideas or questions I like noticed but didn't notice, which without them I might have glossed over a little bit. And then third is I use them as part of actual like active spell work, specifically after having raised energy, focusing in on my specific intent. They'll like bring focus and like a clear aim to mind, and I find they always have a way of responding in a way that like adds a new clarity or a new bit of insight that I then kind of take away from the experience. So that's like how I use them. As far as techniques, I'll admit I'm a poor shuffler. I'm just really bad. I practice so much, and tarot cards are big and hard to bend, which doesn't help. And so
no, they really doesn't. And so it's really interesting to me to think like the original ones being deck playing deck size. That is so much easier to work with sometimes. So if you want to practice, I say practice there.
Yeah. So I have become better and better. I mean, you do anything more, you become better. So I think, I've spent time with these cards, and in all three ways that I use these cards, I follow kind of the same approach of shuffling with my question, intent, or goal in mind. And I'll just keep on shuffling. Sometimes I'll turn, I'll actually kind of walk clockwise or counterclockwise, whichever is more appropriate as I think and as I shuffle. And I kind of do so until my intuition draws my attention softly toward the top, middle, or bottom of the deck. At that point, I draw from one of those places, breaking the deck if it's in the middle. And my spread approach tends to vary a little bit too. I usually draw three cards, each with a specific prompt or meaning, which I state aloud as I'm shuffling I sort of draw that card. So for instance, three might be first steps, something to notice, something to avoid. So kind of, it definitely shifts. I let it kind of connect in with whatever it is. And I'm always staying open a bit once I've drawn in case my intuition is still settling down a bit. And sometimes that results in things like drawing a fourth companion card, which serves as sort of like a buddy through my spell work, or to generally have in my corner if there's no spell to draw us for, or even a total redraw, which is rare, but does happen to me sometimes, turning my initial three cards into like a two card now and then spread. It's kind of wibbly wobbly, but I let the heart guide. I do find it works well when I know what I'm asking, and I'm genuine about it. I'm focused. I'm not letting myself kind of look out the window or check an email real quick while I'm shuffling. I'm doing one thing. I'm in one space.
Do you deal with reverse cards or, cards that pop out? How do you manage those?
Yeah, I do with reverse cards. Do you mean just in how they, in the orientation once I flip them?
Yeah, or... how do you flip? Do you flip top to bottom, left to right?
I flip from left to right.
Okay.
Kind of like opening a book.
Okay.
I guess is just always felt instinctively good for me. And yeah, the card jumping out of the deck thing, again, I'm a poor shuffler, so.
Well, that's, I was curious how you handle that.
Was this me? Was it the card? Does it matter? But yeah, usually if there's a pretty expressly, this doesn't want to be in the deck kind of card, I add that to the mix. And I try to leave it a little bit open. So, I only have one deck so far. So that's probably maybe odd for some people. I haven't been into this practice for terribly long, but I guess it's been a couple years now. But I feel like I've gotten to know it pretty well. I have added one deck, which is an Oracle deck that I did by myself.
Okay, you have a traditional and an Oracle.
Yes. And
so that counts as two. You've got two decks.
Yeah, and I'll draw like a single card sometimes from that at the end of the tarot drawing. And it's like this extra splash of context or food for thought. And so far, every single time, it's provided something really interesting and meaningful. So, yeah, me and the Oracle deck are tight already, like right out the gate.
I really like that, using the Oracle deck alongside the tarot deck.
Yeah, I've been trying that out. My Oracle deck doesn't seem to like my tarot deck as much.
That's really funny.
It's like it's stealing attention or something, but that's a whole other nuance.
Your Oracle deck is sassy.
I will just say, I don't know if this is anything, but it's an Urban Crow Oracle deck. If anyone ever sees it out there, it's really beautiful art and it's really cool. Amazing. I don't have the name of the illustrator.
Meanwhile, the crows have been going intensely loud in the background.
Yeah, I'll happily share this after the fact in case people love crows and are curious about this. But I feel like this crow deck is very curious about my existing deck. It seems to hover above it and perch and have a sense of like, what's going on over there?
Yeah, that is not the attitude of my deck.
I feel like similar to you, I use tarot in a similar way. I use it when I need clarity around something, sort of like that bit of an outside perspective, or like you said, Ash, that sort of lens at which to approach a practice through. A little bit of a guiding force, if you will. Not that I take the results as like gospel, like this is the answer. It more just kind of helps to sort out things that I might already be thinking, already be feeling, but it's kind of it's under layers of stuff, so I need something outside to...
It's a psychologist to, in yeah, form. Yeah,
exactly. Right. You know, and sometimes for me, it helps fulfill that need I have of, I just want someone to tell me what to do. Like, occasionally, especially this past year, I'm just like, I just need someone to tell me what to do.
Sometimes you gotta hear those hard truths.
Yeah, you know, it'll piss you off. But but I will also, like Jay, do pulls around spell work, usually a post-spell pull, just to kind of wrap things up, get any additional insights, sort of do a check-in with myself. And then I'll do a pre-pull cast sometimes if I need help honing my intention. Like, I sort of have vague ideas swimming around of what I want to do spell-wise, but if I want to sort of zero in, I'll do a pre-spell pull just to kind of help clarify things a little bit. Like I said, stuff that's already in me, but I just need an outside perspective. And I've also done readings for other people. I have done this before. Usually if, like, someone's feeling stuck or just... once again, needs to sort out those inner thoughts into something.
Okay, some questions for you then here. Do you often, like, do you use the same deck?
I don't. So
okay. Neither do I. And so I was like, do you use a separate deck?
Usually when I'm doing readings for other people, I will use my Smith-Waite deck for
Me too. Okay.
There you go. Yeah. So my Hush deck feels a little too personal to me.
Yeah.
And that's, it's the artist, I think his first name is Jeffrey. I'll have to double check that. Jeffrey Hush. But it is a beautiful deck that I use. And it's, I found a few years ago, actually. I'd been on the hunt for something that really connected in. And it's a gorgeous deck and I love the artwork, but it feels like too personal to me to use for other people. So I do use my Smith-Waite deck for
other and people. Do you then let them handle it because it's a separate deck?
Yes, I do. Like I want my querent to shuffle while they're holding their question in mind.
Yeah. Do you have them draw or do you do the draw?
I'll do the drawing. So I'll have them shuffle and then hand it to me in the orientation that they were shuffling in. And I'll draw bottom to top and I read it from their orientation. It presents them with their cards. Even though I'm doing the reading, I'll read it from their perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. That is also how I have done it. So
yeah, no.
I'm curious to see as, like, I dig in and learn more. Like, is this, how do we both know this? We've never talked about this is how we do this. So what is it about this shared language of this, like, tarot culture?
Yeah.
Like, is that what everybody... I'm curious to...
Movies and TV. I don't know.
Movies and TV.
Maybe it is. But for shuffling, I am a little bit of a better shuffler.
Wow.
She's, ouch. She's
there's a reason why I shuffle the cards when we're playing games.
She's dangerously good as a shuffler. Yeah. Oh, no, I just hand her the hand.
I can't do the fancy stuff, but usually when I'm doing... And this is a shuffling technique I have done since I first started using Tarot and Oracle Darts. So I'll do the, like, riffle shuffle where it's like the flippy. And then I'll do alternate that with an overhand shuffle, so just from one hand to another. And then what I do, because I do the readings with the reverse, I want to make sure I have a good mix of reverse and upright cards, I'll cut a top third off, set it aside, cut the next third, rotate it 180 degrees, put it on top of the first third, and then take the last third. Huh. So I've got a rotated option in there as well, and then I continue to shuffle.
I will, on occasion, just take them and spiral
them. That's a good method, too. And then restack
them?
I've also seen the chaotic spread them out on the floor and do
I've seen that too.
So that's also a very, very valid option. You don't need to be as fussy as I am. But yeah, I'll just do that until it kind of feels right. And then when I'm doing a reading for myself, I'll do the left to right, like a book opening, and flip that way and read that way. And usually I'll do like a 3-card draw. If I need a little bit more, maybe I'll draw an additional 2 others or 3 others to kind of get a little bit more of a perspective. If I have any surprise cards fall out, I'll usually take a minute because I love my Hush deck, but it is like 20% too big for my hands to comfortably shuffle, and it makes me a little sad. But if I have a card fall out while I'm shuffling, I'll take a minute and be like, okay, was this just a fumble? Or do I feel like I need to set that aside and just kind of like... Usually it's like a gut instinct thing. I'll either set it aside or nope, you're going back in the deck. So that'll be usually be my bonus card. It's usually the card that ends up pissing me off the most.
Well, as they do.
But yeah, at this point, I think I own 6 decks.
Oh, wow.
A mix of mostly tarot. I do have this beautiful Amy Brown art deck.
With that many decks, how do you know when to use which deck?
You know, it kind of, sometimes I just use like instinct, like whatever one's calling to me. My Hush deck is my classic deck I use. And like I said, my Smith weight deck is usually for other folks. So I kind of like cycle between the other decks, just be like, who wants to party now?
My Oracle deck would literally just like be like, you don't want to pay attention to me? I'm gone. See you later. Bye.
Like I said, bye. You got a sassy Oracle deck. I do. I love all my decks. And some, you know, I try not to be an impulse buyer when it comes to decks, but I tend to be. I definitely impulse bought an Owl House themed deck.
But it's so cool.
Shout out to that show. Yes. It's also a really cool Oracle deck.
Yes, we love the Owl
House. Or tarot deck.
You can just buy them for the art. That is allowed.
Right? It's really beautiful. And I love that show so much. It is my favorite witchy vibe show.
You could also technically probably play card games with them.
Oh yeah, I imagine so.
I mean, I don't know if that, maybe that is considered a big no-no.
I don't know.
Is there really anything in
a fair question?
I wouldn't play with my like special decks, but like my more casual decks, maybe. Why not?
I'd be curious to learn some of the playing card games originally and how, like,
I think I've come across
how
like
the triumph
a website
cards,
that teaches
like
you.
Turned into the Major Arcana, and like because we've played some trick taking games with decks where like special cards like that have special rules. Like I could see there being a bunch of unique games you could play.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean in the Minor Arcana there are still the Queen, the King, the Knight, and the Page. So those are still, but like that adds. You know, because there's like 0 to 10, it's your ace,
mm-hmm.
right?
Maybe we should just find a card game that involves tarot and flight one day. I will say one of the coolest things.
And
I'd
watch the world outside us literally turn upside down.
One of the cool things I did with, okay, this is going to get real nerdy, with a tarot deck was it was a D&D campaign, oh my gosh. And one of my characters was given this magical deck of tarot cards. And at the beginning of each session, my DM would have me draw an actual physical tarot card to see what I had in hand to be able to play throughout the session.
It was wicked cool.
And they gave me the option to completely shift my class from cleric to an oracle class in which I wouldn't roll dice. Instead, I would be pulling tarot cards. I was very tempted, but I was so like locked into wanting to be a cleric, but like it was so fun.
What
being
a cool
able
option.
To incorporate tarot into like my nerdy love. It was so fun.
I just want to say thank you both for sharing all of that. I know that this gets into like some weirdly personal stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like tarot is kind of gets into the traditions and even mm-hmm. the little bit of superstitions that we maybe have. So especially for solo practitioners, it can be hard to share those like personal things. So thank you. I am finding that one of the really unique things for tarot is that it both holds a community understanding, but then there's these personal and unique touches that make each thing unique to the witch and the reading. So my goal over this journey, over this, you know, 3 lunar cycle journey is to dig a bit more into that and even, you know, try some things out for myself. So with that, this lunar cycle 1 and 2 have really been about learning, you know, the roots of tarot and then starting to understand all the unique ways it's used in the craft. So whether it's a divination tool, is a meaning maker, or a lens to approach activism, which I'm really excited to read about. So while this round will focus on the basics of tarot, you know, I'm not going to be diving into each card or mm-hmm. any of that. Instead, it's going to be a broader approach to how to doing some of the things that you all just shared so that for those that are maybe, again, getting their first tarot decks or maybe even have been working with tarot decks, maybe you're going to learn something new that you didn't know before. I'm excited as somebody who has worked with them casually but has also been kind of daunted that there's like 78 cards and how do you remember all mm-hmm. of those meanings and all that kind of stuff. So I'm very excited to approach all of that. And with that, I did get a collection of books to kind of help me with that. So I did get a book called A Little Bit of Tarot by Cassandra Eason. And again, I haven't read these, so I can't say for sure recommend, not recommend yet, but I will, you know, share them out. It's a cute little book and it kind of just breaks down, again, each of the cards, but it also has a little bit at the beginning. So I'm excited.
Nice.
To.
I love that it's like almost pocket sized too.
Yeah, it is like almost pocket sized. It's purse sized or small bag sized. And then a little bit heftier.
Ooh, yeah.
is a book called The Only Tarot Book You'll Ever Need, which feels like quite an assumption. But it's a modern guide to the card spreads and secrets of tarot by Sky Alexander and Mary Shannon.
Okay.
So excited for that. It's got pictures. It's a little bit more colorful.
I do love me good pictures in the book.
Yeah. It does seem to, you know, kind of offer the little bit of tarot has small snippets about each card. This is a little bit more in depth and has a chunkier beginning of like how to you know, break down. There's some like universal symbolism, and this is where I kind of get really excited. I'm gonna talk about this more about apparently there's a whole way to read tarot where you don't have to memorize the 78 little things. And so I am really excited to learn more about that like broad pattern, and so that you kind of learn that. And there seems to be, this is a little bit like we were talking about how some of them tied it to the elements and all kinds. So yeah. I'm really excited. I did kind of like peruse through the beginning of this book and I spotted all that stuff and I was like, oh, clearly I'm missing something in this tarot journey. Maybe it will all make more sense when I'm done.
I mean, you should only need that one book per the title.
Well, so. It's just the only tarot book you'll ever need, right? So again, I haven't read it, so can't recommend or not recommend. And then the other one that I got, and I mentioned this earlier, was Tarot for the Hard Work, and this is by Marina Menes. And it is a lens through which tarot applies to activism. And I've actually started this one. It's great so far. It's got workbooks, and I'm doing what she says not to do, so I apologize. She wants you to, like, you know, do the things as you go, but I was trying to read it in time to be able to talk about it. Yeah, yeah. So I'm excited to go back and actually do the work. Sorry. I know. It's not what it's meant for.
You gotta do the hard work.
I gotta do the hard work. So, like, I do apologize, but I just really also wanted to be able to talk about it as a whole. So, so far, it's been fantastic, though, and I'll share a little bit more about that.
I might need to pick up a copy of that for myself. It sounds really, really interesting.
Oh, it's fantastic. I will share a little bit more about that when I'm done with it during my next episode. So, you know, and as I talked about before, I'm interested in exploring the intricacies of how each witch approaches this tool. As I asked Jay and Alyssa, I'm very curious to hear, like, how do you shuffle, store, handle, and use tarot? You know, I know depending on the witch, there's, you know, like we talked about, that strict rule or strict tradition to flip left to right or the top to bottom when you're working with others. You know, a flipped card could have flipped meaning in some traditions. Some traditions actually don't use flipped cards at all, you know. I'm really excited to learn more here and kind of get that out into to just a better understanding of the diverse ways that we use it. But there's so much more, you know. As I was saying, I was digging into that first book, or the second book, I guess, really, The Only Tarot Book You'll Ever Need. tarot can be broken down, not just into the major and minor arcana, but it's often... there's number structure and narrative through line and ways that we can intuit with what each card means without having to memorize the booklet. So excited to explore that. Nice. You'll have to stay tuned. And of course, this is a science-based podcast, which means I really want to look at the math of the probability of all this. And I get it's like 1 in 78, but I'm curious if there's been any studies done or any like casual happenings of like, what is the probability of drawing the same card, you know, in two different spreads within a day of each other? I know that that gets into like probabilities of things you probably can't measure, but it is really interesting to me and I want to see if there's anything out there. I know I certainly have done layouts that repeat themselves a few months down the line and after several shuffles. And, you know, sometimes it just feels like that message from the universe. And so, you know,
Didn't get it the first time.
Or, you know, my subconscious reaching for those same cards. If my hands know that those cards have that particular feel to them. You know, how is that in my body and my subconscious talking to me in certain ways? So, like, it could be any number of those things. So... it's the same reason that I love that we call tarot readings, because we're also, that's what we're doing. We're like making meaning in a narrative out of thing. And from a psychological perspective, this is really my biggest thing with tarot, right? And oracle deck work. You know, the question I find myself most often drawn to when I am shuffling and in trying to like focus in is, what am I missing here? Or what could I bring to this situation? Because ultimately, I'm not expecting the cards to have an answer for me in the sense of like the solution to my problem. But they might help me reflect on what I need to bring, what I'm missing, what I'm not seeing. there's of course confirmation bias at work, but many of us also had that uncanny experience of like readings delivering those hard truths. And if we don't listen, like you said, life will then deal us an even harder truth sometimes. So as part of our community, I encourage you to reach out and share the ways that you work with tarot. No wrong answers here. How do you shuffle, draw, do your spreads, read, store, and interpret your tarot?
Creative passion is both a powerful energy generator and outlet. Mixing fire and air, creativity magic is a wonderful entry into finding a state of witchy flow, where time slips away as we root deeply into our workings. As a fun way to engage this more, as you've heard this year, we've each chosen creative projects, which we've been working on over the year, checking in regularly to explore how working on them is both involved in and enhancing our own witchy practices. So checking in this round for me, things are coming along slowly, but surely.
I feel that.
Life and work has gotten a little bit busy the last month or two or three. So the physical painting hasn't happened yet. It will. I'm taking this time to push further with my planning and preparation, and I'm pretty much ready to put paint to canvas. I've chosen to paint elemental symbols for my set of four little paintings, which will sit at cardinal direction points around the room where my altar sits. It's very nice that our house is very neatly, squarely oriented
really
with the walls, you know, properly perpendicular to longitude and latitude. So I'm delighted by that. This is going to create a really nice light visual system of color and imagery to tap into as I tend to move all around my room when I'm raising energy. And aside from that spellwork angle, it will kind of just set up the whole space as like my magical domain.
I love that. That's very nice.
It sort of is already, but like this is a nice artistic and colorful way to do it. And it kind of expands the altar to be the room, which is something I've thought about for a while of like, could an altar be a room?
Sure.
The whole room?
I mean, that's goals.
Yeah, it is goals.
Yeah, yeah. So so to dig in further ahead of painting, I've started to doodle. I'm like arriving at certain symbol designs I really like. And then once I'm set on those, I'll do some additional sketching for design elements like sizing or accompanying imagery, ways to use the space or negative space of a little canvas.
And I was just going to ask you, so you said you've come to some ideas about some shapes. Are you going more angular shapes, more rounded shapes?
Minimalist shapes.
Okay.
Minimalist shapes.
Common shapes?
Yeah.
Or
just like
more organic shapes?
You know, the sigils work that I was doing got me really into just appreciating like basic curves and lines.
Yeah.
And like how intersection points and just balancing things creates right away like symbolism that means something. And so that's kind of where I've been at of like, you know, if this curve is, you know, right next to this curve, but there's a little space in between, or like this one's slightly up or down, like what does that immediately start to call to action?
Yeah.
Call to mind. And so that's kind of where I've been going with it.
Excited to see those.
Yeah. Once the symbols are done.
It'll happen. Don't worry.
It will.
It'll happen when it's supposed to happen. That's kind of how, like, I understand that I'm a deeply procrastinative person. Okay, but my mentality is that it will happen in the exact moment it is supposed to happen, because when it happens in that moment, it will be the best that it will be.
I do find
that's probably a lie.
No, I do find that these things tend to kind of fall in place just when they're supposed to. I mean, even with books I've been reading throughout this year, or like various topic things that have come up, but always just even planning ahead. If I ever felt like, I don't know, is that going to be the best timing? And then as it just sort of showed up, it was perfect in like certain ways.
I'm big on the brewing phase. Like for me, like I know people are like, oh, procrastination. Mm-hmm. I'm like, actually, yes, I mean, I'm procrastinating,
yes.
But really I'm not ready yet. I'm not ready for that moment to like give it life. And I can give it life a lot faster if I know exactly what it is that I want to give life to.
Yeah. It's like, you know, when you're making a soup, you got to start by taking time to make a really good broth, and that takes time.
Yes, you do, yeah. And so, you know.
I just clearly want soup.
It is soup season. This experience, in terms of learning from you, you know, this experience has already taught me a lot of things, especially that, yes, I
am someone who can make visual
yes,
art.
You, yes, you are. You
which
can.
Has been like this liberating gate that has finally swung open and has stayed that way. And specific to my practice, my imagination wanting to specifically focus on the elements, thinking on them throughout this process, that's definitely been like a solidifying message for me internally. I really do have an elements-based practice. I should lean into it. I love that. That means something to me. And, you know, it's a through line that's been driving me to spend more time digging into elements that haven't been so dominant for me, namely earth and water, with an overwhelming feeling of working toward a craft that's balanced in all four directions, hence the four paintings, ultimately serving that, like, fifth element of which, in sort of a rising tide raises all boats sort of way. I'll admit, I haven't been sure how or if I should have a fifth painting, but perhaps I'm the fifth element in the mix.
I think you are, because I think you could put the sigil on yourself and like then use that to activate yourself in that space.
Or something to place upon your altar. Yeah, something those lines that like clicks those dots into place.
That, or is it time for another great tattoo? So my next steps here are going to be doodle time, set, sketch, test out designs, colors, book some quality painting time for myself when it feels right. I'm feeling a full moon painting session is exactly what will feel like fun and full of energy. So, you know, some next or following full moon that looks right for me, I think that'll be when I turn this into reality.
Sit down with a good elixir.
You know,
the painting, I keep getting these notifications for local like wine and paint situations.
True. Okay, I can spin on this. Yeah. So, okay, I've talked a lot about my things. Now I want to hear about you. So how are things going so far in your, in this process, do the thing phase? You know, we're kind of at different parts along our journeys. Mm-hmm. So would love to hear about that. And yeah, also, what's this teaching you about your practice so far?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie. Things are going pretty great.
Yeah.
I definitely made quite a bit of headway on my project. So a few steps closer to really getting into it and like a few steps closer to being kind of complete on it. I mentioned last time that I wanted to paint as a reminder, I'm doing an embroidery hoop of our version of like the festival year. So
we're going to talk about in the next episode.
Which we will. Spoiler alert. So that is my project. This is creating the new, so instead of it's Ostara, it's Spring Equinox, so this new version of this. I did mention last time that I wanted to paint each of the seasonal celebration sections in their own colors using watercolor paint, and I managed to do that. I, of course, first had to swatch the potential colors, but I didn't want to do that on my project, and I didn't have a lot of leftover fabric to do it, so I used technology.
Yay!
I took a photo of my hoop with sort of the outline stitches that were already in there. I'd already gotten them in there. And then I brought that photo into Procreate, which is just like an artist, digital artist app, and used my iPad. And then using like my little Apple Pencil and a soft semi-transparent tool, I swatched a bunch of colors in each of the sections. And then ended up moving them around and trying different ones here and different ones for this holiday and whatnot until I finally came to a place where I had a color set I really liked and filled in the rest of the color just to kind of get an idea of how it would look. And then came the process of turning it into the real thing. You know, as I had my watercolors and my hoop with my fabric, I also had my iPad set up so I could like easily see as I mixed the watercolors together to try and get as close of a match as I could. I did pretty good. I was, you know, my color theory from way back came in handy.
It's kicking back in.
It never leaves. It's like riding a bicycle, you know? The colors did come out a little bit strong at first as I was trying to test to see how well the fabric would take the watercolor. So, and I did end up struggle with some bleeding into other sections, but, you know, watercolors can be fairly forgiving. So with a damp cloth, I like managed to blot out a little bit of the color and then like figured out a system of painting a section and using my blow dryer really, really quick so that it didn't spread beyond where I wanted it to spread. I also managed to write on my hoop in the lettering for the celebration, so the names of each of the festivals in my pen. And then I have started stitching letters. I went through a few different variations of stitch types because, of course, I didn't test this out on scrap fabric. I ended up doing it directly on the hoop, and sometimes you just gotta kind of do something and then undo it until you find what you really like.
Hey, it's all part of the process.
It is all part of the process. So I have a stitch that I like. I have a script style that I like for the festival titles. And now it's just about continuing that journey. But, you know, I will say something that kind of surprising for me that happened in this working with this and bringing watercolors into the project is just dabbling in watercolor painting, which isn't something I'd done since I was a kid. So
a little bit of that water element.
A little bit of that water element coming in. And I just started, like, you know, doodle painting.
For somebody who doesn't get along well with the water element, I love that you have found a little bit of a way in.
It, you know, honestly, it's really nice and it's really fun because I'm someone who always says, like, oh, I'm not an artist, I'm a crafter, you know, and sort of awakening that little bit more of an artist self, even though it's just silly watercolor doodles of, like, Ghibli suit sprites and a little calcifer. I did a nice little painting of a cauldron, though, that was really fun to do.
It was very nice.
So, yeah.
Maybe finding... she'll share that. I don't know.
Oh,
maybe.
I should. Yeah, I'll share her on
She's
the Patreon.
She's better than she's already. Even her doodling looks great.
But this was really fun. It was really fun to sort of reawaken that part of myself of, you know, not just a crafter, but also an artist.
Oh, sounds like a little bit of play.
Yes. Which is also fun. I was very much, and I'm this way as an adult, but I was very much that child that if, like, an art thing wasn't going to come out perfect, I wasn't going to have it. I was going to have a meltdown if it did not come out perfect. So definitely for a very, very long time, I resisted any kind of play when it came to art or sewing or crocheting or anything like that because it had to be perfect. And I think that doing theater and doing improv specifically,
because
there is no such thing as perfection. There's
in
good
theater, in theater in general. There's
not. Exactly. So I think that definitely allowed me to shed that sort of aspect of myself from when I was younger, and has led to being able to play, like,
lovely.
Especially in things I'm comfortable crafting wise. The other day, I sewed myself a pair of secret pants on a whim.
I mean, I think one of the biggest pieces of advice as an artist that I ever heard, for me at least, was no artist ever thinks their work is good.
Yes. Oh, yeah. My God, yes.
And just coming to terms with that of, like, I don't think this is good. And I was like, well, as long as you get it as good as you can, and that's okay. You probably will never think it's a masterpiece. Will other people? Oh, yeah, probably.
We are our own worst critics.
Yeah.
It's real. It's honest. And, but yeah, I'm really excited about this. I'm really excited with how it's coming along. Once I'm done all my lettering stitching, that's when I'm going to start doing the visual representations of each holiday. And that's going to go beyond, as I mentioned last time, that my intention here is to go beyond the embroidery. Like, I'll do some embroidery, but also do some, like, paint prints of leaves. I'll stitch actual dried press flowers onto it.
I'm
maybe
so
some
excited
charms.
For this.
Yeah.
Are you going to do a similar kind of pre-layout on the iPad again?
Yeah, I think I would like to pre-plan it a little bit, especially if I find, like, specific items, like specific charms and things, kind of visually going through physically.
Take
and
a photo and drag
also
that
doing
in
that
just,
too.
Like,
that was
pop that background out. And
that was really a very, very useful tool.
I
so
love that tool. It's also so much more, I'm like, you know, the old school way would be to go to, like, your local paint store and get paint swatches.
Uh-huh.
And I used to have stacks of these for color work.
Yeah.
And this just really saves
man.
A lot of that.
It does. It does. It's honestly, I really like the blending of the physical work and the digital work. Instead of when I first tried to do this project, doing just all digital work at first. So
yeah, the blend is nice.
The blend is nice.
That is awesome. How about you, Ash?
Things are largely sitting up in a pile, you know, until recently, if I'm going to be honest. I admit that summer months are not the months I really want to be inside and crafting. They are time to be outside. And so now that the rain is settling in and the long dark is starting to happen, you know, my hands want to be more busy, and I'm more into, like, putting on a cozy movie and getting into work. So it's the time of crafting. So, you know, like I said, I'm a little bit of a procrastinator. I want to really stew on things until I have that vision. Unfortunately, with my compendium, I guess for those that following along, I'm working on my spell book or my compendium, right? And, you know, being too many years into my practice, I really like, I want to say 20, but I think it's we're now getting into, like, almost 30. I have a lot that I would want to put in this, right? There's a lot of history, there's a lot of thoughts, but it even has, you know, topics and page spreads for various different things, you know, from lunar cycles to seasonal cycles to our pillars and some of our common phrases and all those kind of stuff. So when I'm like thinking through it, I'm getting a little bit stuck on like that bigger picture, right? And I'm like, no, you just need to pick a page and just start with page.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of that. So it's teaching me, you know, mostly through like my practice that, you know, nothing really unexpected, but that freeze moment or that fear procrastination when it comes to committing to something like a page in the bigger notebook, you know, as though one page will ruin the whole thing. And I know that it won't, right? But it does provide some great lessons along the way about failure, release, the ability to change things. I love that it's that season. So I'm hoping I can let those things go.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, if nothing else, it's kind of a good reflection time on where to let go of perfectionism. And, you know, the perfect thing to release in the fall season, like I said, it's one of those luxuries of digital work that I don't really have in this case because I do want it to be tactile. I have had digital compendiums and I do love the like search and find feature, but there's just like something powerful about hand to heart to paper to like, and then being able to pass on something tactile like that, especially as we move into an era where more and more of our data isn't really our own.
Yeah.
And the idea that it could be erased at any minute. I mean, even think about like, you know, where we store our scripts for podcasts and stuff like that. Those things could be taken from us at any given time. And totally. So, you know, of course, if it's stored on your local computer, it's a little bit different. But even then, there's just something to be said about like a nice tactile thing. Yeah, so
you can't hack analog.
No. which is also kind of fun. I have been thinking about, are there cool folds that I want to do within this book? And like, you know, I really just need to lean into those next steps of seeing something through on the vision, trusting myself, enjoying the process again. I imagine the first real step, though, is to mess up a page.
Yes.
Really
yes.
make a muck of it and figure out how to transform it or release
undo
it.
Undo the stitches.
it's so tough with paper because it's like, okay, so then am I going to tear it out or am I going to fix it? So I am working with a mixture of stickers, pressed flowers, paper types, some cloth, and, you know, other tactile appliques. So I can get really creative. I'm still just really not sure that I chose the best book binding.
The physical binding.
Yeah, because it's got a really thin binding on it. And I'm just like, it's going to break the binding with everything that I want to put in here. Or it's going to just really make it flare out, which is fine, I guess. But, you know, so I'm like, okay, well, does that mean, like, should I not get started yet? Because I don't think this is the right base. Mm-hmm. But I love the size. I did come across a really cool social media video of somebody making a book out of paper bags.
That's
and it was about the same size and it had pockets. I don't know. I love pockets.
Yeah, you love a good pocket.
I love good pockets. And maybe pockets. After just like, you know, the feminine part of decades, centuries of not
being
having
denied pockets
in my clothing. But I just like when something has, I'm like pockets. So I really do. There was something about that I kind of liked. So I think that may be my big sticking point. So I just wondering if I should be changing the base structure, if it would ease some of my apprehension about moving forward. Guess I'll find out. So I keep thinking though of like, how do I transform what I have? Maybe I do just break apart the binding ahead of time and then use that and like restitch it with gap in between. So that would, you know, take on learning a new skill to rebind, but I'm excited for that.
Perhaps a very witchy binder.
I don't want a clip binder.
I just love a good binder. You want the book. You want the book from Practical Magic. You want the aunt's book.
You want the tome.
Yes, I understand.
Name the property. It's a big book in Charms, big book in Practical Magic.
There's a big book in Hocus Pocus. Like,
I want that. Yeah.
Yes, it's the need for the big book. I understand it.
So there's always some option to, you know, move forward, whether it will be around it or through it or just transforming the whole dang thing.
No one ever said this topic was going to be a straight line for any of us. And I think that is my favorite part about
Mine's
it.
Mine's just been a dot.
It's a chance to learn about ourselves, right? Like, ultimately, every creative endeavor gets to teach you a little something you didn't know before about yourself. And then tell that story in something that didn't exist before. So I'm excited about all of this, and I'm excited to see where it keeps going.
Resistance Radio, warrior witch tuning in to bring you ways mundane and magical to fight fascism, kick capitalism, protest patriarchy, and converge with community. All while we decolonize, deprogram, and fight for anti-racism, equal rights, and trans lives. And of course, knowing when to rest and regroup, for that in itself is an act of rebellion. This lunar cycle, we're addressing the quiet subversive. This role takes on a very different approach from active noncompliance. When we talk about quiet subversion here, these are quiet tactics that one can take that in some cases actually require absolute discretion. Now, this might show up in ways that you can, you know, low-key participate, like how you spend your money, or it might require a different level of work and discretion as you build safety networks that provide access to goods and travel paths for care or things that have become inaccessible. I want to be clear here that we need every voice in this fight, and silence is compliance. But there are some roles that do require a level of subtlety, a level of depth and connection that will require learning how to signal safety without shouting it from the rooftops. Now, this podcast is a little bit of the antithesis of that.
That's true.
And we as a group continue to have conversations about our role as a bit of a beacon.
Mm-hmm.
Versus the silent networks that will offer the boots on the ground, safe spaces, and access networks. Those groups are actively working in underground revolutions, need to know when and how they can be of use, and how to be vocal in just the right way. Quiet subversion isn't an excuse to let other voices dominate the conversation. It requires that we be present and put in just as much work. For those of us in blue or even purple states, we often hear people announcing that folks can reach out for access to housing, birth control, Plan B, and other tools. While the intent here is really great, by announcing this, you immediately make it a non-option. You are no longer that safe space. One role for the quiet subversive is truly the low-key operative. Maybe you do want to be the one that does stash up on birth control and Plan B, or has started keeping a library of banned or restricted books, or can offer easy access to travel routes, helping get people from one place to another. Do not put a target on yourself. Being a beacon comes with risks, risks that you then pass on to anyone who engages in what you are offering. This is where it will become more important than ever to consider how we communicate. With surveillance of most of our digital and even physical world, we're going to have to get smart and crafty. We, as a group, have even talked about training in ham radio skills. But really, I think of the women who quilted messages into blankets, or the enslaved women who used the braids in their hair to pass along messages. We have long understood the need for revolutions to have quiet threads that weave the layers together. May those who need them find them. So to get started here, consider what resource you might quietly stock up on or offer. Maybe it's offering a bedroom for recovery or driving someone to a clinic. Maybe it's gathering books and birth control to make sure your community continues to have access. It might be about gathering information, documentation, and story to make sure that these things don't quietly disappear. That is another key aspect here, being keepers of knowledge, wisdom, and story. We must make sure that the stories and voices endure, and that will be up to us. This includes telling the stories of those in war-torn countries, those being captured by ICE, by those who are losing their jobs, or going hungry because of the economic shift that is sliding through the world. It's also up to us to make sure that what we have learned about our history isn't lost to history. We've spent a lot of time undigging the past. It's not the time to start reburying it. It will be up to us to help keep those stories. As a witch who can see our way forward, this may be even more key to our roles. Remember, though, the quiet subversive still requires action. It requires you to put values into movement, and that means paying attention. That means not looking away. Because yes, we must rest, but we must also fight forward like our world depends on it.
One way to fight as a quiet subversive is to flood the system. Flooding harmful systems with a massive influx of junk so they can't operate. For example, let's say you know of a call center set up for reporting on people doing things like attending drag shows. Signing up this number for spam and marketing calls can gum up the gears and can be done from the comfort of your own home without any level of personal connection to this choice. Fair amount of anonymity here. Similarly, the maelstrom approach can both build community and create impact, namely via a storm of postcards or phone calls to make your opinions clear, This approach isn't anonymous exactly, but when coordinated across one or more groups, it's been proven to warrant attention, and phone calls and physical mail require receipt and processing.
Yep.
So large volumes are more noticeable than, you know, hundreds of emails or text messages, which can be much more quickly sorted, deleted, ignored.
It becomes a physical problem for them to deal
with. Yeah, they gotta put it somewhere. And some witchy magic to this one. Physical cards and phone calls are both mediums through which you can add an extra oomph of energy.
Or a sigil or two.
Connect with an intention when you write those words or speak your truth. Make them hear you on an energetic level. Especially in numbers, that's a powerful storm of signals you're putting out there. And then there's one that's been practiced for centuries, probably longer. Boycotts. It's a little known fact that the Boston Tea Party was not actually the biggest pain in Britain's butt, but rather the silent boycotting of wives and families choosing not to buy goods from England. And not only that, but to gossip about those who did.
Shame on those.
Boycotts continue to be a powerful lever you can pull where your values don't align and who wants your hard-earned funds. When it comes to where you spend, there are some obvious choices here, thanks to the public capitulations of companies like Target, Paramount, and Amazon, a few big ones who've pandered shamelessly to the Trump administration. That said, to know where every piece of everything you buy is coming from is a superhuman feat. Thankfully, there's helpful tools good people have worked on to help, including sites like opensecrets.org, where you can look up how any company and its employees have contributed to political campaigns. And beyond spending, where you keep your money is another choice you can make, and the opensecrets.org site also helps here. Ethical investing is tough. It just really is. And so a good resource I've found here is a site called prisonfreefunds.org, which lets you look up funds from your 401k, like the specific funds that your money is sort of split into, to see how the individual companies that are connected to the prison industrial complex or military defense contraction and things like that. An especially important issue these days as deportation holding facilities, more accurately defined as concentration camps, are now in operation across more states and areas in the United States. I still can't believe that's a sentence of accuracy at this moment, but that is why making choices with your money is an important way to get your own dollars out of that racket. To wrap this boycotting action, a brief comment on financial well-being and inequity in our society, if you don't mind. This game of boycotting is certainly going to be shaped by your own needs, right? Just to be real here, where you live, the choices you have access to, the intersectionality of identities that make up who you are, and the privileges in this society that you may or may not get to enjoy. You know, if you live in a food desert and you can only access healthy food options at Walmart, then please shop at Walmart. Please get your healthy food if you need to. We're in no way advocating for putting your own needs or health at risk so you can take a political stand. Just like we've mentioned already, this resistance needs all kinds of actions and roles to be taken up. So if boycotting is not in the cards for you personally, that is okay.
If you want to keep things local, caring about your neighborhood is another path of the quiet subversive. And no, I don't mean joining your neighborhood watch. I mean keeping an eye out to make sure that hate speech is not being spread around where you live. See a swastika sticker on a lamppost? Remove it. Or better yet, cover it with something that spreads a message of love or hope, like a Trans Lives Matter sticker. Is there a poster hanging up outside your local grocery store advertising a group or event that is rooted in some racist rhetoric? Bring your concerns to the store manager and work to get it down. If they don't listen to you, get your friends and neighbors to start complaining as well to put the pressure on. This is where, if you are a white person, you can use that privilege to your advantage. You can even take it a step further by doing things like posting your own stickers, hosting your own events like an LGBTQIA+ knitting club, and using that to drown out the hateful noise. This is also where much of the advice we gave you in episode 144 on being a good neighbor can come into play.
And a great mix between that neighborhood care and that boycotting we're seeing happen when we see big media conglomerates decide to bow down to the fascist regime. And not only are we seeing the boycotting because people are deciding to not engage any longer with subscriptions and those companies, but then the neighborhoods are showing up to protest outside of or remove or, you know, reach out to advertisers and, you know, no longer, you know, participate in those businesses. So lots of ways you can combine some of these actions to make an effective full loop.
Yes.
We love seeing a community come together on these things. And speaking of, one of my favorite aspects of a neighborhood are little free libraries. We touched on this a little bit and the importance of building your own resistance library in episode 142. But here, I'm going to talk about really giving time and attention into tending these community resources, because this is what they are. I used to live in a neighborhood with a lot of little free libraries, and I would peek in them often, drop books off, pick books out, but I never gave much thought to helping maintain them. If you're digging around your local little free library and you see a book that either promotes hateful rhetoric or false information, just go ahead and remove that book. No one needs that in their life.
Prune that bush.
Just, yeah.
Sometimes you gotta just like
trim the hedges there.
Well, we're not supposed to be there.
What you do with that book is up to you. Additionally, add books to the library that you want to see go out into your neighborhood. Science book, histories, protopian novels, whatever you find helpful in building the community you want to see. Be a member of your village.
So what is your action this time? This lunar cycle, you might try on the quiet subversive by engaging with some of the following actions. Monitor your neighborhood for any hate speech signs or flyers. Take these down or replace them. Participate in Project Mailstorm or something similar. Develop a network of resources and a way to communicate. Boycott companies that support fascism. Local businesses will have big impacts on your community. Keep a library and stock your local little free library with hard-to-access books and inclusive stories. Document, document, document. Thank you so much for joining us for this new moon brew on tarot. I will return at the full moon for a focus on my learnings and hands-on experience with tarot as a tool within a science-based practice.
In the meantime, you're always welcome to spend time in community with us in our monthly Sunday Havens and in our Discord community server.
And join us on Patreon for the newsletter and behind-the-scenes podcast fun, and on social media where we're doing our best to shine light on our favorite creators, educators, and activists.
And until next time,
keep your world witchy.